Do you like the Star Wars? Well, you've come to the right place yet again, because the Rantcore Pit is back, and we are going strong, despite the fact that simultaneously the entire Rantcore Pit are at AllCon in Addison, where you should be if you're not already.
That's right, that's right. It has been a crazy, crazy couple of weeks leading up to AllCon, but it's going to be worth it, because if you have not experienced AllCon, you're missing out. It is an amazing event.
Absolutely.
And yeah, we're all going to be there, the whole group of us, Cole and myself, Catherine, Colleen, Bobby, Andy is making a special appearance all the way from Arizona. So yeah, you got the whole group showing up.
Rick Gutierrez from the United States of Geekdom.
Yeah, Roy Buckingham.
Pretty much Roy Buckingham, yes, from the Rediscovering the Magic and Cult Film Fanatics. So you've got this chock-a-block full of personalities you've heard on a lot of these different shows that Eddie and I are on.
That being said, that's the reason why if we are a little off tonight, it's because we were probably working off of just a few hours of sleep, you know, these past few nights.
We have been doing almost nothing but AllCon. At least I certainly have. I know Eddie's been just plugging away on AllCon stuff, on Rancor Pit, on he and Colleen's new show Figments here on the Jedi Cole Universe podcasting network. Plug! And...
Does it count as a plug if it's on your own show?
Sure, absolutely it counts as a plug. Every plug we can get. It's,
I love it.
And we're shamelessly seeking every plug. And the thing about it is, first off, if you are unfamiliar with AllCon, visit all-con.net.
It's ORG. I think it's ORG.
Or actually, ORG and NET both work.
Oh, it does.
So
I interchange
them periodically
to
mess with people. But, you know, we're going to be there, of course. There'll be several. There's just stuff going on all weekend. By the time you're hearing this, AllCon will already be at least a good day old.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to have been Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday this year.
Mm-hmm.
That's March 13th through the 16th. When you're hearing this on Friday, we're already going to be there. And if you get over there in time, check it out. I'll be doing either Friday or Saturday night. I have lost track of time. The Jedi Cole Universe Live.
Where we
have a very special treat for Star Wars fans and for comic fans. There's a little bit of the entire Jedi Cole Universe all rolled up into that. And
yeah,
a very special treat you'll eventually get to hear on the JCU is we'll actually have a recording when it's repeated on Sunday, Jedi Cole's Morning After, which is my other talk show on Sunday morning at AllCon. I'm doing a little treat. The little gag I worked up. Movie trailer rewrite theater. And for the first ever movie trailer rewrite theater, we have Captain Phillips.
Oh, gosh.
And I'm going to leave it at that. If you want to see what my reworking of the part of the trailer for Captain Phillips is like, be sure to be at AllCon or listen in later on when, through the courtesy of Rick from United States of Geekdom, we'll have a recording of Jedi Cole's Morning After. And now, without further ado, let's get on into the meat and potatoes of this particular episode. We're going to talk about the art of Star Wars, because Star Wars has a tremendous connection to art, from concept to screen to everything beyond.
Exactly, exactly. It's such a big part of what makes Star Wars familiar to people visually. The concept designs that have come from not only the trilogy itself, but going into the prequels kind of brought a little bit of a different flair to the Star Wars universe, probably to the complaints of many diehard fans. Nonetheless, the prequels also contributed quite a bit visually to, you know, pop culture.
Absolutely, and I think that's the important jumping off point, is that conceptual art, because that was a big part of selling the concept.
Yeah.
Of selling the idea of this being a workable thing when science fiction was box office poison.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And, you know, who's going to touch this? So a real visionary artist, I think, was discovered in bringing Ralph McQuarrie on as conceptual artist. I remember as a kid not really liking his art that much. I guess because I saw what came of it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Once you've seen...
It's so different. Yes, it's so different from what it grew into.
Exactly. And it was, you know, but you can also, as an adult looking back, you can see the inspirations. And you can see a lot of the vision and a lot of what he brought to the table.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the ideas of just like things. If you've ever seen the conceptual art of the Millennium Falcon in the docking bay at Mos Eisley, in addition to being just a wonderful little rendering with a hypothyroid Ewok Chewbacca. But you also have this great sense of, like, there's relatively low ceiling. It's kind of a weird illusion, and you know, relative to the Falcon, the ceiling in the foreground is rather low, but relative to the characters, it's not really that low. They could all stand on each other's shoulders.
Yeah.
Still need help touching the roof or the ceiling. But then there's, like, a thing, some sort of equipment or crane or gurney or Lord knows what, and little, you know, ventilation slits or drainage slits or who knows, and symbols sort of painted on the wall that have faded with age. And there's just this sort of, you get the idea that McQuarrie got it right off the bat.
Yeah. That piece in particular is very powerful, especially if you look at it through the eyes of people who are seeing it for the first time prior to the movie being released. Because you have the figures, and they're so tiny compared to this big, vast hangar and this ship. You get the sense of how big the Millennium Falcon actually is, because it's drawn so big in this piece that it's actually cropped off. It, you know, because the painting itself can't contain the entire stretch from, you know,
exactly,
ship to
and it works beautifully in that way, that it seems both cramped and gigantic. All that's a bizarre sort of way to present stuff, and I think that ceiling in the foreground helps break up the scene.
Mm-hmm.
But you get that distinct impression that, you know, he got it, he understood what this needed. And then you see the scene, that another of the famous conceptual paintings is Vader and Luke dueling on board what was presumably not originally intended to be the Rebel ship, or maybe it was, because Luke's wearing breathing apparatus, because he doesn't have his built in like somebody we could mention.
Yeah.
and I think what's really cool here is, you know, I love that the swept design of the Vader helmet in those early McQuarrie works. And I just think it's just, you can tell that that's what the finished product progressed from. Mm-hmm. And what's really cool about it, and I had not really noticed this, I don't think very consciously, is I think Vader's packing heat.
I think you're right.
I am pretty sure he's got a sidearm.
I'm pretty sure that's what it is. That's such an interesting design, because it's got a little bit of a samurai feel to it, like in the line work. And it wasn't until later on that I realized that is what I think Lucas was trying to convey to McQuarrie, was he was using kind of that old feudal Japan armor and getting, you know.
I think very much so, because it's an interesting juxtaposition of, you know, when you've got lasers, when you have these blasters, why do you need a sword? You know, even if it can cut through anything.
A sword.
A sword, yes. And I think that's one of the neat things that you get, especially in this, when you realize, like I just did, that, you know, Vader's got a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought a gun to a sword fight. They both did. Mm-hmm. And they're still going to have a sword fight.
Well, you know what? Speaking of swords, in the early concepts, the stormtroopers had I was about to say laser swords.
Lightsaber. Laser sword, yes.
And they had, didn't they carry shields? Didn't they have, like,
shields? They had shields as well, which really,
so
either, you had to either question the effectiveness of the shield or the overall effectiveness against anything of the lightsaber. And I think, to me, that always suggested that conceptually the lightsaber wasn't originally meant to cut through everything.
Exactly.
It was originally meant that you could probably lob off people's limbs and stuff with ridiculous ease, and that happened throughout the saga, of course. But I think that the idea of just, like, you know, cutting holes in bulkheads with it, about as likely as, you know, cutting through somebody's front door with your katana.
It's
might be able to lop their hand off, but you're not going to be able to slice their door down.
Yeah, exactly. Like everything else with the concept art, it evolved as it went along. It's almost like, you know, like with the earliness of Superman, you know, everyone just assumes Superman could always fly. But as the character of Superman progressed, you know, his powers evolved along with it.
Oh, precisely. But what's really cool about that McQuarrie, the Luke and Vader, is boom, right there, out of the gate.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if this was already designed and then, like, oh, here, put it in this background, or if this was actually McQuarrie's own design, but just judging from a lot of his own work that wasn't Star Wars, I think that he's responsible for the look of the Rebel Blockade Runner.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With, for some reason, 10,000 lockers. I don't know. Apparently it was originally a high school in space.
Galaxy High.
Exactly. It was like, you know, Napoleon Dynamite and Pedro coming over to work there.
Nice.
Worth the combination.
I see you're drinking 2% blue milk.
Nice. You could drink the whole blue milk if you wanted. Cause you're not like that guy over there. They pointed at his job.
Oh, man. But yeah, the McQuarrie concept art is so interesting to look at. And you look at R2-D2, he's got, you know, it's almost like, I guess he's supposed to be walking with all three legs as opposed to rolling. And he's got that these little skinny little arms, robotic arms popping out of him. It's so unusual to look at now.
In fact, the original concept was that R2's gait was supposed to be akin to a person walking on crutches.
Uh-huh. Okay.
If you put that in your mind, imagine somebody walking with crutches, and they're throwing the crutches forward, then they're throwing their body and their leg forward, then the crutches forward, and the body. That was the original idea. I suspect that when it came down to the brass tacks of practicality, it was like, you know, that would be great. It's not going to happen.
Exactly. They couldn't even get him to roll half the time, much less walk.
It would be interesting, I think, to see in some of the like cartoons or something, maybe to have an older model droid. Mm-hmm. I think it would be cool to have that kind of gait, because if you're animating it,
mm-hmm.
and that would be one of those great little nods to, if you get it, you know, if you know what we're getting at.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the very few of the Clone Wars I ever saw, there was one that where there was part of a subplot where there was some kind of big slug in the Coruscant sewer system.
Oh, yeah.
And the design of that was right out of concept sketches for The Empire Strikes Back, for some of the wildlife of Dagobah that just pretty much got remanded to a spiny back and a bunch of pet store boa constrictors and iguanas.
Uh-huh, that's right. Even moving into Empire Strikes Back, I remember there was a concept piece for the Empire where the Tauntaun was Isn't it like a lizard or something, like a raptor type of creature?
There were a lot. I'm trying to remember precisely which of the McQuarrie, because I mean the one McQuarrie that I remember very distinctly, the Tauntaun is brown and has a nice set of fangs and.
Okay, that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, it seemed like it was almost a little bit lizard-like, but it's been so long since I've seen it.
Now, there were a lot of conceptual art. If you've ever seen the Star Wars sketchbooks, which have a lot of the, you know, everything from the giant 6-foot turkey to
yeah, exactly,
or 12-foot turkey in that case. That was just really, thank goodness they did not go with that one. To some of the other designs, that there were some very reptilian ones, and in fact, in the oddly enough, just tangenting off of that, there was a in the novelization of The Empire Strikes Back, the Tauntauns are actually referred to as reptiles.
Oh, okay, wow.
So something of that concept. But I think really, as you go into Empire and you go into Jedi, mm-hmm. you're seeing, as a conceptual artist, McQuarrie benefiting heavily from others already pre-designing a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Where a lot of it is more like, you know, conceptually poor dressing the idea of how a scene might be laid out or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less of just the out of nowhere, you know, like right off the cuff type of stuff that you would see in Star Wars as it was back then, or A New Hope. So in a way, to me, like the earliest stuff is almost the most pure. Because then the lines begin to blur, you know, because by Empire, the design of the Falcon, anytime you see the Falcon in an Empire or Jedi artwork or the X-Wings or any of that, they look exactly like they're supposed to look. They don't look different.
Yeah.
Where in Star Wars, there's just a lot of stuff that isn't quite precisely the way it would look, because there wasn't a finished piece to go by.
Uh-huh, exactly.
And then you see a lot of the stuff that was where the concepts are more like the pre-fleshed out, like the scene with Luke and Vader dueling.
Mm-hmm.
You get the distinct impression that McQuarrie came up with the cool disco kind of like a set piece from Donnie and Marie or something you'd expect.
Oh, God.
A staircase along those lines.
That's messed up. Oh, my gosh.
And now you'll never look at the, you'll just have this dance number. I'm a little bit country.
Let's not take it there. You really are.
I have ruined Star Wars for
I think it's Alcon. You're so sleep deprivated from preparing for Alcon.
I'm also getting kind of punchy. I have to be a little silly for.
Yeah, you got to be.
For my talk shows and stuff. So be ready. Because that Captain Phillips thing is going to be out there, trust me.
I can't wait for that.
You get a lot more of the sense that McQuarrie is being utilized more to conceptualize scenes and give you, you know, here's something to throw out there and show people what we have in mind.
That's true, yeah.
More than just out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. But then again, you know, there are those elements that are just pure McQuarrie, that there's something about his style that you can just tell that, you know, the weird replacement of windows on the Death Star must be a nightmare.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, do you need the the lower semi-left quadrant piece, or do you want the one that's just above it? There's so damn many frames.
Yeah, exactly. There
was
really
one with like 37 pieces of glass. No two the same size.
Exactly.
Like, who designed this place?
What psycho? I think where McQuarrie really shines through in the trilogy, like where you could just see his work, is in Cloud City. Because when you look at Cloud City, how it turns out, it's so much like his concept work, not only for Star Wars, but his pieces that he's done for other things. It's almost like they lifted it right out of a painting. And what's also interesting, and this just shows how amazing of an artist he is, I didn't realize as a kid that a lot of the backgrounds that we were seeing in the movies weren't actual sets, that they were paintings that he did that were later added in.
Yes, there are a lot of McQuarrie matte paintings, and I think, you know, being, 15 or so when Empire came out, and being by then so silly for Star Wars, I was very steeped in it. You know, I had a good concept of the scene where the Falcon is on Cloud City. There is a McQuarrie matte.
Yeah.
And they're coming out to the landing gantry. And to me, that always just looked too much like a painting, because I knew that it was a McQuarrie, just from looking at it. But, you know, then on the same token, the more I encounter that image, the more I see the tremendous influence that the man had on the look of Cloud City.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, especially if you're going from Star Wars, where your principal habitations, you see, the principal collective humanity or everybody, the only city you ever see is Mos Eisley, the only large population center. And you go from that, where it's all stucco and, you know, it's like some sort of reimagined version of Santa Fe.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's Santa Fe 2099. Only
presented by Stan Lee, it sounds like.
That's exactly. To, you're going to the, you know, going to this gleaming ultra-tech city.
Yeah.
And it's all just these, like, it's towers a-go-go, because there's nowhere else to build. I mean, you only have X number of square miles of surface area.
Yeah.
In the habitation portion of the city. And then the rest of the city is given over to the mining operation and actually staying afloat, I would suspect.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's a tremendous aspect there. But I think it's there that you really see, because they use so much of his art for, like, the scene where Leia goes to the window and gets buzzed by both of the Top Gun guys in the same vehicle. You know, I just imagine these twin pod cloud car pilots zipping by there. I feel the need for speed!
Goose and Maverick.
Yeah, Goose and Maverick, I'm sorry.
Flying the cloud car. That's a new one. Again, once again, proving that you're the king of mashups.
I will draw anything together with anything else. Give it half a chance. Absolutely.
But you know what's interesting, before we move on to other artists, is one of the matte paintings that shows the trench on the Death Star. It's so funny because it's almost like the walls are nearly just slick. You know, there's nothing to them almost. Whereas, and I'm going to steal this phrase from your friend Steve, in the finished design, it's all covered in fiddly bits.
Fiddly bits, yes. We actually stole that from Douglas Adams.
Oh, okay.
That's where Slarta Bartfast is talking about Norway and having all these little fiddly bits around the fjords.
That was interesting how it went from so simplified to very, very not simplified.
You know, that's an interesting point, because I would suspect conceptually early on, you know, a trench is a trench, and it's just, it's part of this great superstructure.
Exactly.
And I suspect when it got down to the practical brass tacks again, what you wound up with was, that's going to look really dull at high speed.
I mean,
may as well just have it flying past poster board.
You know, like the high school set designer.
Exactly, you know, like
created this.
It's like a UIL thing where you just have to use those gray shapes, you know. And nowadays they may not even have to be limited to that, and they'll be like, "What is this guy talking about? What is this grandpa?"
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that, you know, when it got down to it, you had these designers saying, you know, this conveys the idea, but it's going to look pretty dull if there's not some contrast there. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they just went nuts with the tchotchkes and the fiddly bits and the little Susu Studios everywhere.
You know, we talked about in an earlier episode about, I guess it was the Me Too episode, and we talked about how Battlestar Galactica kind of was a Me Too of Star Wars and the look and design of it. And I didn't realize this until after we spoke about that.
Yes.
McQuarrie was actually the concept designer for Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just sort of like the family married out or something. You had so many people, John Dykstra coming over and
that's right. That's right.
Supervising effects, and you had McQuarrie brought in. It's like, let's do Star Wars for television. Who can we get? I know Star Wars people. They know Star Wars.
Let's get everybody except the cast members to be a part of this.
You know, one of the interesting things is if you go back far enough, when the Falcon was originally what would become the Blockade Runner, the neat thing is there's a concept piece that has the Falcon docked somewhere. I think it was back when A Cloud City was part of the original script. And the cockpit, of course, was meant to be much smaller than and in fact was largely retooled as the cockpit of the Falcon. But all the little fiddly bits in the front end of the Falcon that you can kind of see through the window. You know, you have that strange sort of round picture window right up front where people can see all your equipment and stuff, but you can't see out beyond it because there's all kinds of equipment and stuff in the way. And that was already there in those designs, is all those little bits and pieces and stuff right up in front. So to me, it's almost like having a clear hood on your car or something.
Exactly.
So I guess, you know, nowadays you practically could because they're pretty close to perfecting transparent aluminum.
Are they really?
Yes, they are. It's not actually aluminum, but it is transparent. So.
The future is here, folks.
That's right.
We just need flying cars.
Need flying cars for a long, long time. But certainly, yes, by Empire, you're seeing a lot of things like the shaft work in Bespin with the inexplicable gantries, vanes, and balconies and whatnots out there. And you see a lot of that going on, and especially just the interiors and exteriors for Cloud City. And this really kind of this sense of curved lines and overstated elegance. I don't know enough about how to define the look, but it's not really deco, but it draws some influence. You can see a taste of deco there.
Yeah, I could definitely see that.
But without actually being deco. Probably upset some of the aficionado or some of the pioneers of Art Deco.
We just lost that crowd.
Yeah, it won't be the first time. And then, of course, you move then into Jedi. And I think that it's at that point where a lot of the artwork, it was more like he's going from concept artist just to illustrator.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, here's some scenes, and publishers are going to want to do a new book on the art. And so you're not seeing as much of just the ground level design, you know, creating the designs. It's almost more illustrations, or that's just the feel I get. I could be dead.
No, you're right about that. I mean, with the exception of just a few things like, say, Jabba's Palace or the Imperial Shuttle, I guess there's not a whole lot of new things being introduced. Well, the Ewok Village. A lot of things are already repeated from previous things. You have the AT-STs and the AT-ATs, you know, on Endor being repeated. You have Tatooine. So there's a lot of repeat elements, and there's not a whole lot of room for new designs.
Yeah, so you just really kind of get remanded to just illustrating what's already there.
The Death Star is basically just another Death Star, just incomplete, and you have Dagobah once again. So yeah, there's just not a whole lot of different locales.
It really is. It's like, oh, here's it's the Death Star with Pardon Our Progress.
It was the early version of Lego Death Star.
Yeah, it was really interesting, though, you know, as I was looking around at some of the Macquarie stuff, too, I knew he had worked on a lot of the design work for Battlestar Galactica,
mm-hmm.
but I did not realize that he had done work for Star Trek.
Yeah, I came across one thing where he painted a very, very odd-looking Enterprise.
Yes, it's like the Enterprise you would build in shop class.
That's a good way to put it. I wish I had the image handy, because it's been a while since I've seen it, but I remember it was almost like, good night. I can't even describe it. It reminds me,
if you're
going to
make me take shop, I'm still going to wear my fly my geek flag.
Yeah, wasn't the middle body part like a triangular shape?
Yeah, it was very triangular in shape.
It was very unusual.
It's awkward. I mean, literally, I think just what you would build for shop is the best possible description. Because,
or if someone dared you to just, you know, hey, go into Thrift Town, buy whatever items you can, and assemble the best looking Enterprise you can possibly.
Yeah, whatever you lay hands on.
Exactly. You know what also is interesting is you would think with as big of a hit as the Star Wars movies were, and how happy Lucas was with what McQuarrie brought to the table, once they began production on Raiders of the Lost Ark, you would just assume that McQuarrie would have been the designer for Raiders of the Lost Ark, but he wasn't. And that's interesting to note.
Yeah, that's a very good point as well. And I just wonder if there was, I mean, you know, like Harrison Ford was never the first choice.
Yeah.
For Indy. Uh-huh. And I think there was, it may have been a sense of a disconnect. You know, we were trying to not use all the same people. Plus, uh-huh. I think with Raiders, McQuarrie, just looking at a lot of his other work, brings, you know, he was an illustrator of very, for lack of a better word, futuristic things.
Uh-huh.
So it was ideal for something that was, at least at its core, chock full of the futuristic.
Yeah.
What you wanted, I think, with conceptually with Raiders, was to be able to convey a different time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you want somebody who has that just built-in innate sense as a designer, in much the same way that McQuarrie's work captures a world that doesn't exist. You need somebody who can, in that same way, breathe life into a world that most of your audience never knew.
Mm-hmm.
That's both familiar and unfamiliar simultaneously because of the time difference.
Yeah, yeah. Which is probably why they went with someone like Steranko to bring a feel that, you know, it was almost like the concept art for Raiders early on reminds me of the old pulp covers of some
exactly.
of
the. Exactly, and Steranko was a good choice for that because he had that kind of two-fisted action.
Uh-huh.
You know, the man had, when he wasn't doing psychedelic op art.
I'll admit
Shield, you. Yeah, from
uh-huh.
McQuarrie, then, but, you know, it always had that kind of pulp, as you said, feel. I think that's a very good way of putting it, because at the end of the day, you need that kind of, mm-hmm. you know, rough and tumble Saturday morning
adventure
movie. Yeah, adventure serial.
Sure. And the only time his artwork shows up in Raiders is that illustration where it's them opening the Ark.
Oh, that is a Steranko.
Yeah.
I guess that's why it has that kind of op art feel to it. With it.
No, not Steranko.
Oh,
McQuarrie.
Oh, McQuarrie's art. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, where he's talking to the government officials,
yeah,
and he shows them that piece where it's got all the Israelites or whoever, you know, down on the ground, and the Ark is being opened.
Yeah.
That's the only time Ralph McQuarrie ever touched the Indy universe.
I did not realize that.
Uh-huh.
But well, you know, once everything's out there, the cat's out of the bag,
yeah,
then it becomes kind of an open season sort of thing, where you have a lot more artists involved.
Yeah.
And I think at this point, you and I were discussing before the show some of the notables. I mean, there we could do a whole series. We could do a whole podcast series forever on, you know, who were the big influences in Star Wars art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think we're going to touch on personal favorites. So if we have missed anybody that's a personal favorite of yours, that's solely because they didn't happen to be personal favorites of ours we talked about before the show. And not to impugn any of the artists that we will undoubtedly fail.
Because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It is chock-a-block full of artists who are just amazing in their own right.
Yeah.
Who should we touch on next? Do you want to head into, like, chronologically speaking, head into the Marvel series, since that grew out of the movies?
Yeah, I think, you know, with the important disclaimer that we're probably not going to be precisely chronological throughout, because I don't want to try to figure out who got into doing Star Wars things first, but I think certainly when it wasn't the movies themselves,
yeah,
and later some of the stuff that came from those movies, personally, I was all over the comics for all 125 issues and three annuals, even before I knew there were any annuals. I first found out there was an annual, the first annual existed, when I saw someone selling original art from said annual at a convention.
Oh, nice.
And I asked to see it, and it said Star Wars Annual Number 1 on the info lines. I'm thinking, okay, when is this coming out? Oh, it's already come out.
It's in the quarter bin, kid.
Yeah, by then it, you know, of course back then it was harder to find stuff, but there was certainly a character from one of the artists who was prominent in the Star Wars series, whose art style I hated. And yet, I can't imagine the series without his art.
Uh-huh.
Was Carmine Infantino.
Tell us why you have such a dislike of Carmine Infantino. I know what I do as
I
a
think,
kid.
I think a lot of it was just, it's almost like there's a geometry to his art.
Uh-huh.
There is this harsh, very specific line from men with beards that defy gravity to... I mean, I have to admit that, you know, as I got older, there was something about his style that, I probably shouldn't even mention this, but there's something about the way he drew the female form,
uh-huh,
that became more and more appealing as I got older.
I know how to feel.
Because there is something about that geometry that's very delightful.
Are you talking about Leia's Wonder Bra?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought that's where we were headed.
You know, there's just this sharp, angular, here are their
tests. It is. Oh my gosh, if I could recall, it was one in particular where...
He was doing Spider-Woman, it's the same thing. Hey, there they put an eye out, wow.
Because his run was pretty long. I think it was very lengthy. The issue I'm thinking of may have been somewhere in the 30s. I think it was the very first page. As soon as you crack it open, in that first page is Han and Chewie sitting in the cockpit with Leia leaning over. And yeah, I was like, "That's
they sell you at the money shot right out of the."
Yeah, it's like those aren't moons; those are gazongas.
Wow! Check out the twin suns. Whoa!
that's exactly.
They're not
it.
Sons, but they're definitely twins. But yeah, if you look at like 3PO,
uh-huh,
you know, everything about him was much more sharp and angular. Everybody was sharp and angular, from their chins to their noses. I mean, even Chewbacca looked like you could cut yourself on.
Yeah, yeah. It's like he'd even try to get anything of a likeness to any of the actors. That just wasn't in his game plan.
No, I think you got this vague impression of... Okay,
just a vague, very vague. I mean, there's one cover where Luke could very well have been He-Man dressed as Luke Skywalker, because he's just...
You know, oddly enough, He-Man liked to dress as Luke Skywalker. I finally got to see that lost episode.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah, they weren't going to air it, but you can find it sometimes at conventions.
But at the other end of the spectrum from Carmine Infantino is one of my personal favorites when it comes to the Star Wars comics, and that's Al Williamson.
Al Williamson, yeah, was I think of the two names that, especially if you grew up with the vintage, the classic Star Wars from Marvel, those were the two names you remember most. And they were like, I guess there are some other people.
Yeah, yeah. Because I bought Star Wars comics on and off as it was going on, but it wasn't until two things in particular. It was, I believe it was Star Wars 81, and it's The Return of Boba Fett. It's the issue that came right after Return of the Jedi. I bought the Return of the Jedi miniseries and was blown away, and that's what got me collecting Star Wars on a regular basis from number 81 on. But Return of the Jedi, the adaptation, you know, he illustrated that, and he also illustrated The Empire Strikes Back. But I was just blown away with how these were practically like photographs of the actors. You know, it was like snippets of the film illustrated on these comic book pages. And I just couldn't believe how he just nailed the likenesses. And I was so young, I didn't know anything about, well, this is this artist and this is this artist. I just knew what appealed
to me. It just got a lot better.
Yeah, yeah. And
that's interesting to juxtapose those two artists, where the insanely angular and geometric work of Carmine Infantino was often off-putting. The one thing he did well was make very angular versions of the existing ships.
Yes, yes.
But also try to bring in additional spacecraft.
Yeah.
That weren't part of the Star Wars universe outside of those comics. And ultimately what happened when you go into Williamson, you get much more accurate likenesses. You know, Luke looks like Mark Hamill playing Luke Skywalker.
Uh-huh.
You know, they look like the people who played them, and Chewbacca looks more like he did on screen, and you know, everything. But there, if it isn't the Millennium Falcon or an X-Wing or some existing design that he can draw from,
yeah,
it's a rocket ship.
Yes.
All of a sudden, Buck Rogers.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about the one from television. I'm talking about the one from the Saturday morning serials.
Yes.
Is, you know, you just these flame-belching rocket ships were everywhere.
And that was the thing. You know, when it came to the mechanical part of the Star Wars universe that wasn't already preset, or the creatures that we weren't already familiar with.
That's right, yes. Uninspired, I guess.
Like, almost like you were looking at Flash Gordon and not Star Wars. And even sometimes when he did tackle the pre-existing stuff, I remember I was heavily into the Star Wars Galaxy cards because they brought in all these different artists. Well, there was one card in particular that he drew of the Dewback and the Sand Trooper, and it doesn't look like a Dewback. It looks like an iguana, like a large iguana.
Yeah, like a big lizard with the condition.
And although it's an amazing piece of art, and it's very, you know, you get to see the life that he was breathing into this Dewback, and the Stormtrooper, the Sand Trooper was a dead-on likeness, it wasn't a Dewback. It was just a giant iguana.
And most of his creatures were giant iguanas or something similar for the most part. And yet, like you say, you would get these images where it was just, like, so dead-on.
Yes.
But then there would be, like, other things that were... also, very Flash Gordon-esque would be, like, if they went and landed on a planet.
Uh-huh.
It looked like, you know, oh, we're back on planet Frazetta.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it never... They were always, like, mushrooms and...
Yes, giant mushrooms, like a billion mushrooms, or
and weird tangling vine trees.
Yes, and it wasn't just that. It was like even simple things like the way he would draw moss growing everywhere, or the way
you couldn't go anywhere that wasn't covered in moss,
or even like if it was just a simple mountain, instead of just being a mountain, it was like a spire castle looking peak.
Oh yeah, very, very craggy and fiddly bitty.
Yeah. Philly Bitty. But I know
it would always be like planets in the background and stuff. So you think about on a Star Trek episode.
Uh-huh.
You know, the entire sky was littered with planets. And everything you do, if you look at it, anytime there's like moons and planets and
that's true.
Lord only knows what in the background. But it's very busy compositions.
That's true, that's true.
I mean, it must have been murder for the man to illustrate The Empire Strikes Back and have to draw ice fields.
He was
probably just out, can we go in and maybe where these mushrooms are, make them like, I don't know, snowdrifts? just a thought there. I really don't think we're going to see many mushrooms, much fungal growth of any kind on this particular base. But otherwise,
yeah,
you know, we're liking this.
Yeah. Yeah, for the little bit of bad, there's a whole lot of good to like about Al Williamson and his art.
And ironically, when Al Williamson does Flash Gordon, it's dead on. It is so dead on.
I would hope so.
It looks more like Flash Gordon than Flash Gordon.
I would hope so.
I don't really think that's actually what would be defined as irony, but there you go.
Oh, goodness gracious. That's crazy.
And I did have to point out that one thing that about going back to Carmine Infantino really quickly.
Sure.
Is it was all about the noses. In fact, I don't think I ever completely put my finger on that until there was some kind of thing where in one of the ambush bug things from DC where they were showing this very clever thing. It was like ambush bug as designed by all these other artists. Or as drawn by those other artists, and whoever the artist for this book was, did this great thing where it was just like an extreme close up of his face, and it was all nose.
Oh, God.
I thought, you know, that's what it was. That's what always was kind of bugging me, always about the nose. It was very nasally.
He had a nose fetish.
Nose fetish. He really. Really liked him some nose.
Noses and pointy boobs, I guess that was his thing.
Yeah, right. I guess, you know, they're both sort of angular protrusions, so.
Gosh.
That's it's bound to happen.
Wow, man, we've gone down a road. If there's anybody still listening to this episode.
Yeah, exactly. I came here to listen to something about art. What the hell?
We applaud you if you're still listening.
You deserve a medal at this point.
Yeah, so does
Chewie. Unless you're a Wookiee.
No.
They don't believe in that.
No, not.
No. Mm-hmm. Turns out there just wasn't anything in the budget to make all they could do to get two of them fabricated.
As we go from just the Marvel side of the comic books, let's go a little bit into the Dark Horse part of it.
I'm not as familiar as to who did what. I mean, I know there was some amazing art and a lot of their stuff.
There really was, and like everything else, it was hit and miss. And I'm not going to be familiar with the artists' names right off, but you had artists, like the artist who was illustrating Heir to the Empire, even though it was more of like a little bit more of a, I wouldn't say animated look, but it was just a little bit more stylized. It was fun, it was energetic, it was really, he nailed their likenesses in a very simplistic sort of way. And then you had other runs on books that, you know, it was really, really mediocre, where you were just thinking, okay, gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, you wanted Carmine Infantino to come by at the back
to rescue.
Yeah, but one thing that I think a lot of people are really familiar with when it comes to the Dark Horse comics are the covers of Dave Dorman. He, and not just for Star Wars, but for a lot of things, it's obvious that in his illustrations that he really gets reference photos and he works off of those things until he gets them down pat. You know, the Dorman covers to Dark Empire, that was probably one of the main selling points in that book, getting the attention it did.
Oh, absolutely.
Because he brought the feel of the old-style movie posters right there to the comic book cover. It was already exciting enough as it was to get Star Wars back in comic book form for all of his fans who were just salivating, waiting for him to come back. But to get these books with these gorgeously painted covers, and the likenesses were just dead on. I mean, it was just like, you just wanted to take these comics and put them in a frame and hang them up on your wall.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing is that with his work, it was, like you said, it was kind of gave you the feel of the movie poster, also sort of married to the concept of the illustration.
Yes.
So it's sort of the best of both. And, you know, all of his work from the comic covers to book covers and these works that were done, you know, specifically for prints and the like.
Mm-hmm,
are just amazing. There's like one of my favorite images is one that he did of just a collection of different droids, and it just typifies exactly what his work is like and how much attention is paid to capturing the look and the feel of the character and everything about them.
Yeah. He really got the look and feel of Star Wars, and even with the characters and the ships that weren't already pre-existing in the trilogy, he understood the design work of what went into the original trilogy, and he carried that over into a lot of the illustrations he did for Dark Horse.
Yes, he did.
But as good as Dave Dorman is, there's one.
Wherever could you be headed?
Yeah, there's one painter in particular who, if I could wallpaper the interior of my house with his artwork, not just Star Wars, I would do it, and that's Drew Struzan.
Well, he is literally kind of the illustrator's illustrator when it comes to a lot of the fandom stuff that we love so well.
Yeah. I mean, he has, his body of work in just Star Wars alone is just so impressive. Aside from, like, the special edition posters, which are beautiful, and of course, the episode one, the prequel movie posters, that's probably the best thing about the prequels, is the posters. But just all the book covers he's done, just the dozens and dozens of covers he's done for the books. He did a 4-piece set for TV Guide when,
oh, that's right, yeah,
when episode one came out, and I mean, talk about a fanboy moment when you're going grocery shopping and you're checking out the counter and you look up and you see Obi-Wan.
How dare you, TV Guide?
Yeah, I know, exactly. I never bought a TV Guide in my life. And there's Obi-Wan and half of Darth Maul's face looking at me. I was like, what the heck? And I pulled it off the rack, and then I pull it off the rack, and then Anakin is right behind it. I was like, what? And lo and behold, there's four different covers. So not only were they making me buy one copy of TV Guide, I had to buy four copies of TV Guide to get the
naturally
whole set. But of course, being the big Struzan nut that I am, I had to do it. Yeah, his work is just, it's just unbelievable when it comes to Star Wars and Raiders and everything else that he's tackled.
Well, and he definitely brings so much in that same sort of way of capturing the character and giving you everything that, you know, that you're into Star Wars for.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Like I said, there's so many billion places we could go with as far as the art and artists, because mm-hmm. there's so many who brought so much to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you've ever been to, like, especially Celebration, seen the artists who are there, and oftentimes creating a limited edition print solely for that weekend. It doesn't even last the entire weekend as far as, you know, what the print run is.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some amazing stuff going on out there. And so we've touched just a very little on some personal favorites, the ones that were very much a part of our own Star Wars experience, and hopefully in the process got you thinking about those artists that we didn't mention that mm-hmm. were very much a part of your own. You know, got you thinking about a lot of who's out there and who's been doing all this this work within the realm of Star Wars art. Because art is so, as we said at the beginning, very much a part of what Star Wars is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what's perpetuated it this long.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Well, actually, we probably shouldn't close out the show unless we touch just, you know, even briefly on Doug Chang and his contribution to the prequels.
That's true. Because even though, at least to my way of thinking, there was a lot of work that seemed out of place.
Uh-huh.
It just did not feel Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, that being said, and I feel the same way, believe me, I think by the time they got to episode 3, they kind of started to correct themselves and kind of make the connection between point A and point B. That being said, you and I are looking at it as fans from an era back in the 70s and 80s that grew with Star Wars as it progressed. You talk to some of these younger fans, and they are very passionate about the artwork of Doug Chang and his designs on the prequels. Because that's their Star Wars. That's the Star Wars that they experienced.
True.
I definitely agree with you. I see how they're... It almost suffers from the Al Williamson syndrome, where it's Star Wars, but then it's kind of lifted out of what you knew Star Wars to be.
Exactly.
But it's there. It's part of the Star Wars history now, and people, you have to accept it. One design he did that I thought was odd, I'm not sure how much of this was him and how much of it was Lucas, but it still kind of irks me to this day, is the design of the battle droids. I've never been a fan of the battle droids. I think they're silly looking.
It took a long time for that one to grow on me. The design of the Gungans is harder for me.
Really?
And I'm not sure how much Chang had, and how much of that was his involvement, and how much was other designers. But it just seemed like they were trying too hard to put too many elements,
mm-hmm.
like the big hand-like, you know, the ears that were like the hands, like a decrepit creature from the Black Lagoon hands. And
Yeah, it could be worse. It could have had people hands for ears.
That's true. Could have had Bobby Blakey people hands. But, you know, it just seemed like there were far too many things, you know. It failed to do exactly what the design for Admiral Ackbar succeeded in doing, and that was to combine a number of elements. They just, and I think maybe part of it was just Jar Jar. But at the same time, I think that it was too much like, here's what we can do.
Yeah.
Because we can do anything.
Oh,
unlike
yeah.
Akbar, where we had to be mm-hmm. more practical in the realization of what we were shooting for, here we can do whatever the hell we want, so we're going to do whatever the hell we want.
Yeah. That's exactly the mentality I think they had in going into the prequels.
And I think one of the biggest problems is, unlike characters like Akbar, or any number, I mean, I don't care how outrageous the original trilogy creature was, in general, you never see them, you know, out in their environment, in their habitat, doing anything other than being briefly appearing in a scene.
Yeah.
So, when you have the opportunity to see a purpose-built design at work in its natural habitat, it begins to fall apart when it seems decidedly ill-adapted to said habitat.
Yeah.
And if you look at these supposedly aquatic creatures, they're not very well designed for, and that's just me, you know, being overthinking things as I often, always did. It just seemed like sort of a cluster of different designs, like it was cobbled together from five or six different things.
Yeah, you had like the beak of a platypus with, like you said, like the...
Yeah, I guess you got your bug eyes, your little sticky FBI stalk thing going on, and you got your people hands, ears, and you got your weird little filigree skin tone. And
yeah, exactly, even down to the speckled spotted skin. Yeah, it was almost just like a mashup of, let's take this, and this, and let's piece it together, kind of like...
Let me see more. It was like going to the Golden Corral buffet, just tossing everything on top of each other.
I was going to say chopped. They gave them all these ingredients. And they
then you get the table, and Ron Sanchez is none too thrilled.
That, I could definitely see your distaste for the Gungans, you know, Jar Jar even aside, but with the battle droids,
they kind of grew on me a bit, but
they still have it. I still look at them; they still, to me, they're too much like a marionette. The way they look,
it's a good way to put it. And I think also that, you know, part of the problem is that they don't look substantial enough to even support their own weight, which is minimal.
Yes, exactly. Well, you know, you talk about the Gungans. I know we're going long, but I had to say this too. Another thing that I remember seeing early, when I started seeing the work early on of Naboo and the Gungans and the creatures that they rode, I thought, it's like they were bringing Dinotopia into the Star Wars universe.
Wow, Dinotopia.
Well, because all the Gungans, they had all these big dinosaur creatures, and they had harnesses on them, and they had these things right on their backs. It was very Dinotopia-like to me.
Yeah, in a way it was. Cause, you know, at first, I didn't really think about it that way, because beasts of burden had already been pretty well established, because mm-hmm. you had Dewbacks, and you had Banthas, and Tauntauns. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you didn't tend to drive all your ordnance around on their backs.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a good point. I hadn't really thought of it that way.
I tend to make a good point every once in a while.
That's why I invited you on the show. Another guy, Skippy McFitterson, that I was considering just... He never makes a good point.
Skippy McFitterson.
Skippy McFitterson, yeah. You know, I'm just...
You are getting punchy.
I am. I'm very punchy. This is like mental exercises for AllCon.
There you go.
ALL-CON.org or .NET, your choice. Check it out. Come out and see us. Say hi. Uh-huh. Come and buy a copy of your first year here, the official collection of the You Are Here comics from the Jedi Cole Universe, Jedi Cole Sunday Funnies. A full year's worth before a full year has even been published on the website. So you can see into the future.
It's like Back to the Future almost. But yeah, I can't wait to get my copy and to get it autographed by both creators of You Are Here.
And we will be very happy to autograph anyone's copy if you can track both of us down simultaneously or alone or in pairs. Like Slinky, Bobby and I will be happy to sign. Well, not that Slinky will sign your book, but regardless of if we're in the same place at the same time or on opposite ends of the show floor, track me down and I'll sign your book for you.
And since we're doing shameless plugs, if you're going to be out at AllCon, if you're familiar with Figments.
Oh, yes.
The Mysteries Podcast.
Newest podcast of the Jedi Cole Podcasting Network.
Yeah, that plug. Myself and my wife Colleen do. We're about to release, probably as you're hearing this, the fourth episode would already be up. But we're actually going to have the chance to do two, not just one, but two live shows at AllCon. We're going to be doing our first one on Friday night, very late Friday night at 11 o'clock. It's going to be Bigfoot, Mothman, and Other Mysterious Monsters.
Chapstick. I have waited 8 years of podcasting for somebody to use the word Mothman.
God.
Bless you.
Oh, man.
Freeing me of that life debt.
Oh, and then on Saturday, gosh, now you threw me off. As you always do. On Saturday at 4 o'clock will be our second live show, and that's going to be...
Yeah, McFitterson couldn't handle this.
Yeah, it's going to be the mystery of... whatever his name, McFitterson. It's going to be...
Skippy McFitterson.
You'll
recognize him when you see him this weekend.
Gotcha. It's going to be Roswell, Area 51, and beyond. So if either of those tickles your fancy and you're going to be out at AllCon, come by. Bring your questions, because you can be part of the next episode of Figments.
And we might even do a live-on-the-fly recording for this very show.
Yeah, I plan to at least go around and try to get some audio bits from known Star Wars fans who are going to be in attendance. So,
and even unknown ones.
Yeah, exactly. And at the very least, we'll have something pieced together as an AllCon Rancor exclusive.
There you have it. I think we've covered this about as well as we're going to cover it in our time frame.
Yeah.
Certainly covered it to our personal satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
Again, apologies to absolutely all of the thousands of artists that we left out, because there are a lot of you, a lot of folks that you guys, I know, wish we'd talked about. So if you are really keen on this subject, or indeed any Star Wars subject, and you think you can fare better than old Skippy there, drop us a line at jcumail@yahoo.com, because we would love to have some guests on the show that we didn't know already. You can also follow the Jedi Cole Universe on Twitter at TheJediColeU. You can find us on Facebook as facebook.com/TheRancorPit.
It's The Rancor Pit, okay.
The Rancor Pit, yes.
Okay, like The Star Wars.
The Star Wars.
Ah, there it is, yeah. Facebook.com/TheRancorPit.
We haven't mentioned this in a while, or if we have at all, I have no idea anymore. But at AllCon 2014, you will be hearing from us at Jedi Cole Universe Live, long-awaited, big announcements
yes.
about this very show.
Mm-hmm.
The future of this very show hangs in the balance.
It really does.
Actually, it's nothing, you know, treacherous or anything like that, but nonetheless.
No, tell them it is. That way they'll come out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. You got to come out and help us.
Help us, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Your only hope.
Only you can be a part of hearing this announcement there.
Goodness.
With your ears. And with that punchy, bizarre admonition there, come out and see us at the AllCon. Keep enjoying the Star Wars, and we will talk to you again in a couple of weeks with more Simple Tricks and Nonsense.
Good night, folks.